Good morning. My name is Jeffrey Martin. May it please the court, I represent the appellant Stephanie Smith in this matter, who was present in the courtroom here this morning. We're here because we have filed an appeal based upon what we believe was the wrongful granting of a summary judgment below in the trial court. That decision, in large part, turned upon the issue of constructive discharge, which I recognize is not an issue that has been addressed specifically by this court, at least to the best of my knowledge. But before getting to the issue of constructive discharge, Your Honors, I believe that the court inappropriately, the trial court inappropriately weighed the evidence that was put forth by way of discovery in an effort to draw a conclusion that there was no constructive discharge. In fact, Your Honors, we had elicited many facts, many of which were just simply dismissed after having been weighed by the court. Indeed, the court below characterized the acts of retaliation that we felt did underlie the constructive discharge as a handful of slights.
Mr. Martin, if your contention is that the trial judge erred as a matter of law in granting summary judgment.
That's correct, Your Honor.
If that's the case, then there must be in the record at least one or more master facts that, if true, would entitle your client to judgment as a matter of law. So what exactly are, what is the critical fact, or what are the critical facts?
Your Honor, as I said a moment ago, I believe that the issue that upon which the summary judgment was granted was this issue of constructive discharge.
Yes, and that's the issue I'm asking you about.
Yes. And, Your Honor, there were a number of facts that I cited.
Well, you threw out a lot of them. I want to know which ones are really pivotal.
Yes, sir. And I'm here to do that. Your Honor, my client was told in mid-December of 2006 that if she did not leave the university, her life would be hell or miserable or words to that effect. Indeed, my client had already at that time scheduled surgery, which was scheduled from January 5, on or about January 5, and she had a leave scheduled from January 5 through February 16th.
Right, and that surgery was unrelated to any issue in this case, correct?
Well, sir, I believe it's interwoven.
Was it or wasn't it? Did she schedule surgery because she was told that he would make her life hell?
No, sir.
Okay.
That had previously been scheduled.
Because if she has her surgery, she takes leave, she comes back, and then she resigns.
That's correct.
And
the reason I said that, Your Honor, was because the trial judge said, well, look, the threats were that he made were unsubstantiated. They were not met. And I suggest to the contrary, that when she was in the hospital
and use the word empty, they were empty threats?
He did use that term as well, Justice Ridgely. He did.
And the record shows otherwise?
Yes. And what I'm about to say is that when she was on her five or six week leave of absence, medical absence, chief, in this case it was James Overton, the chief of police for Delaware State University and the chief of public safety, defunded her program, a program that she had put together. It was a cadet program wherein approximately 30 students were employed as police cadets. And as soon as she returned to campus, she was blasted by the director of that program, asking her why she, you know, destroyed the program, why the program was no longer in existence. And she simply, she said she did not do that. And in fact, the evidence is pretty clear that that Chief Overton was the one who defunded the program. So that was a major event.
When she returned to the university after her surgery, she resigned, correct?
She did, sir. There was about 11 or 12 day gap.
And is there, did she testify in a deposition as to the reasons why she resigned at that point?
She
could have, for example, resigned before the surgery. She didn't. She came back. What does the record show?
Your Honor, she certainly could have. The surgery was scheduled. As we know, health benefits are very important to all of us. And it would not have made sense for her to resign prior to her scheduled surgery.
My question is, did she get testimony as to the reasons why she resigned at that time? And if so, what is the testimony?
She thought that, she said that the situation there at work was miserable for her. The other management was not paying attention to her. She felt, in essence, ostracized by Chief Overton through his actions.
I need not your characterization of the testimony, but what the testimony really was.
Yes, sir. I'll find that in the record. I do have the...
Can you explain to me the elements of constructive discharge and how the record establishes a genuine issue of material fact that's in dispute that would deny the other party the right to summary judgment?
Your Honor, yes, sir. As I've acknowledged, I don't believe that this court has set forth any type of definition or really has ruled on this concept of constructive discharge in this context. But through my research, through review of Superior Court cases as well as U.S. District Court cases, generally accepted definition, and it's an objective standard, is that the plaintiff is required to show working conditions so intolerable that a reasonable person would have felt compelled to resign. That seems to be well accepted, you know, throughout the community with the courts who have ruled on this issue. And, Your Honor, I actually understated in my brief. I said that there were six acts of retaliation, and I set them forth on pages 7 and 8. But in addition to the ones that I've just spoken about, the statement by her chief, her direct supervisor, that he was going to make her life hell, and then the subsequent defunding of her program. There were the other issues that had occurred in this interim. And by interim, I mean from the time in late October of 2006 when Ms. Smith approached Chief Overton and said, we can't do this. If Captain Baker is going to carry a sidearm and wear a police insignia, she must be certified under COPT. That is well documented in the record. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions in that regard. But from that time until the time she left, we had the other instances.
Help me understand this concept of defunding the program. Things with budgets tight, things get defunded all the time, and does that automatically imply that there's a basis for every reasonable person to leave under that circumstance? Weren't there other duties as part of this job?
There certainly were, Your Honor. But this was a pet program that my client had initiated. There was absolutely no communication from Chief Overton to Ms. Smith. However, during that interim, Ms. Smith made several overtures to make sure that this program would be funded. She knew that, you know, he had to sign on the dotted line in order for this program to continue.
Well, is your position that the fact of this defunding created the intolerable work environment, or this sent a message that there was going to be an intolerable work environment?
Your Honor, I think, quite frankly, it's the combination of all eight factors. The statement that your life is going to be hell, the defunding, plus the issues, the other issues that I noted specifically in the brief, wherein Chief Overton removed my client from the supervision of Captain Baker. where Chief Overton, sorry, having some problems with my vision.
But how many other people, if any, did she still supervise after that?
She did supervise a few, Your Honor, but this was somebody who was in the direct chain, if you will, on the police side of the house. I believe that she had other administrative people that she was supervising. There was also the cessation of the daily meetings that occurred. Chief Overton had daily meetings with my client up until the time of the of her report of the improper or the lack of certification issue, and after that, my client testified in deposition that they changed drastically, much less. My client also testified that she noticed hostility that other management staff toward her. And also there was the issue of a write-up that was directed by the chief, a write-up of one of her subordinates, Sergeant Baynard. And she did that, although expressing a reluctance to the chief about doing so. She went through the process at his direct command, only to have Chief Overton overturn that after the discipline was announced to the individual, Sergeant Baynard. And perhaps as a final bit of retaliation before she left for her medical leave.
Retaliation for what?
Retaliation for her numerous reports of or her numerous whistleblowing reports to both Chief Overton and also to Major Harry Downs.
All related to Officer Baker?
No, sir. I mean, yes. Yes, the issue of certification is is only with regard to Officer Baker. Officer Baker had come in August of 2006. She had not been working previously as a police officer, at least for some period of time. She had a history of being a police officer, however. But when it came to October...
But let me stop you for a moment.
Yes.
You have a laundry list of events that took place over a period of time during the plaintiff's employment. And I thought your argument was that those events in combination created an situation that a reasonable person would consider to be tolerable and that would justify leaving, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. I understand that conceptually, but now you characterize all of those events as retaliation. I don't know what that adds analytically. But,
well, it may not add analytically, Your Honor. These are events that occurred that were contrary to Ms. Smith's interest, that occurred subsequent to her reporting to both Chief Overton and Major Downs.
All right, so she regarded these as retaliation?
Yes, sir.
Does it matter,
sir,
if they were retaliation?
Does it matter? Yes, it does.
Because we would have to agree with you that these could be considered retaliation for her complaints regarding Officer Baker?
Your Honor, yes, you would need to agree to that. But, Your Honor, when Chief Justice Steele asked me about the definition, the working definition at least, that I proposed of constructive discharge, it's very clear in the other cases. Judge Slice, for example, in the Lipson matter in 2001-2002, said this is a fact-driven matter that is to be given to a jury to determine. While the court is permitted to weigh evidence to a certain degree, the way the court weighed the evidence here was just to the extreme, to the point where the case was literally taken away from my client.
Your position then would be facts along the lines of she resigned 1 week after her medical leave, effective March 9th, but Chief Overton requested she stay till the end of March, and she did. Then she resigned, and then sought employment as a consultant in the very same place, the Department of Public Safety at DSU. And then when June of 2007, she applied for unemployment benefits, her application didn't mention anything about whistleblowing or any retaliation or any hostile work environment or anything else.
That's correct.
Now, is it your position that it was incorrect in determining whether there was a genuine issue of material fact in dispute for the trial judge to weigh those types of factors in granting summary judgment to the other side?
Your Honor, I believe that it was an error for the judge to weigh them to the degree that he did. This court in the Soberos decision.
I'm not sure what you mean by the degree that he did.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, I have a quotation from Chief Justice Vesey's decision in the Soberos that I think may be helpful in terms of analyzing the extent of weighing that might be permissible by the trial court. And that says, if a trial court must weigh the evidence to a greater degree than to determine that it is hopelessly inadequate ultimately to sustain the substantive burden, summary judgment is inappropriate. Your Honors, the type of weighing that this was done here, I set forth in my brief on pages, I believe, 16 and 17, a litany of about 16 different items that the court looked at and summarized. I don't think that's appropriate. I think that this is a fact-driven situation that should have been given to a jury to determine whether, in fact,
with regard to, say, the unemployment compensation claim, she did not refer to the whistleblowing as part of that. Is there evidence in the record explaining why she did not do that?
No, Your Honor, but I'll offer this, if I may. I do employment law almost exclusively. 99% of the people who come in with what appears to be a whistleblowing claim are not aware of that. It's not the same as, you know, I was discriminated against based upon my race or my age. Whistleblowing is a fairly new phenomenon in the state of Delaware. The Whistleblowers Protection Act is not more than 7 or 8 years old, to the best of my knowledge, and is not terribly well publicized. So there were a panoply of events that occurred and hit Ms. Smith between the eyes, Your Honor. And in June of 2007, she wasn't sure exactly what happened. All she knew was that she had to get out of there. And if she felt that she voluntarily resigned, she would not have applied for unemployment, because we know you cannot get unemployment under those circumstances. She knew that she was driven from that position by Chief Overton.
Well, I asked this before. Let me ask it in a little bit more pointed way. Did she testify in a deposition or by affidavit that she left because of retaliatory conduct by Chief Overton and or an intolerable work environment?
Your Honor, she talked about the intolerable work environment, but please also recognize I did not ask her these questions. This was defense counsel by way of a deposition.
The record shows this is critical.
I understand.
You ought to have it at your fingertips.
Yeah, Your Honor, she said that the condition was intolerable.
She did say that.
She said, without using that term expressly.
Well, what term?
But she knew she felt that she was being undermined. She did use that term. She felt that she was being undermined by the chief.
That was her term?
Yes, sir.
Did you want to save your last few seconds?
Yes. I'll do that. There's 37 seconds for rebuttal.
You can use it now or use it later.
If the court has any further questions, I'm happy to respond.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, I'm Kathleen Fury McDonough, and I represent Delaware State University. I'd like to introduce to the court my colleagues at council table, Michael Rush, from a colleague of mine at Potter, Anderson, Kroon, and Thomas Preston, a member of the bar of this court and general counsel for Delaware State University. There are three issues raised by the plaintiff in this appeal. I would like first to address the issue that the court has focused on during the plaintiff's presentation, and that is the issue of constructive discharge. Plaintiff asserts that she was wrongfully terminated in violation of the Whistleblower Protection Act and in breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. That's her common law claim. Both of these claims depend on the plaintiff proving that the circumstances of her departure from Delaware State University were those that constitute constructive discharge under Delaware law. A plaintiff, of course, may prove a claim of some kind of wrongful termination, whether it be under a statute such as the Whistleblowers Protection Act or state or federal discrimination laws, or a breach of a common law duty such as the duty of good faith and fair dealing, if in fact she has resigned. To do so, she must prove that the circumstances of her resignation amounted to constructive discharge. There is no separate claim under Delaware law for a constructive discharge. That act must first be proven, that is, the circumstances of the departure of the plaintiff from employment must be such that they meet the standard under Delaware law for constructive discharge, and then those acts must be tied to the cause of action that the plaintiff is claiming. Here, Whistleblower Protection Act violation and breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
You agree with Mr. Martin's characterization of the elements of constructive discharge or the definition of constructive discharge under Delaware law?
I do, Your Honor, and I believe this court, what I don't necessarily agree with Mr. Martin about is that this court hasn't addressed that. I believe in the Rizzitello case, I probably should refer to it by the defendant's name, McDonald's, it's a little bit easier to pronounce, but in the Rizzitello case, this court affirmed the grant of summary judgment in a case where a plaintiff claimed there was a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and that she was constructively discharged in breach of that covenant because acts that she claimed were racially discriminatory caused her to leave her employment. In the Rizzitello case, this court, while not having a lengthy discussion of the circumstances of that plaintiff's departure from that employer, the court clearly laid down that standard, that in order to prevail on a claim for some kind of inappropriate termination based on a statute or a common law duty, the plaintiff, if she has resigned, can prove constructive discharge if she can prove that the working conditions to which she was subject were so intolerable that a reasonable person would have felt compelled to resign.
Just in terms of the the black letter legal issues, you're saying that there were two causes of action that were formally pled. One was breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and the other was the Whistleblowers Act.
Those two, Your Honor, that relate to constructive discharge, and a third that does not, and that's the defamation claim that wasn't necessarily addressed during.
All right, and is it the case that constructive discharge is an element of both of the causes of action that relate to her resignation, her being forced to resign?
Yes, Your Honor. In order to prevail under either of those causes of action, because she resigned, she must prove that she didn't really resign. She was actually constructively discharged. So to prevail on either claim, she must prove constructive discharge.
Okay. The next question is, what part, with respect to that aspect of the case, that is not the defamation, but the claims relating to her resignation, what part of the trial judge's opinion are we reviewing? That is, did the trial judge conclude that none of the acts that the plaintiff was relying on caused her to resign, or did he assume that they may have caused her to resign, but they weren't acts that a reasonable person could conclude amounted to intolerable work conditions?
I believe he concluded the latter, Your Honor, that these acts taken together did not constitute intolerable conditions such that a reasonable person would have felt compelled to resign.
Can you explain to me how that is an issue of law and not a question of fact to be resolved by a jury, if indeed any of those facts are in dispute? is this, let me restate that. Is this a situation where none of the facts are really in dispute? All these incidents occurred. The question is, you couldn't draw an inference from them that's favorable to the plaintiff.
That is exactly, in this case, what the Superior Court found. In this case, the court found that as a matter of law, the plaintiff does not have sufficient evidence that would allow a rational trier of fact to find that she had prevailed, that she had brought forth proof by clear and convincing evidence that she had been constructively discharged. And in this case, Your Honor, contrary to the plaintiff's argument that the trial court weighed the evidence improperly in a way that disfavored the plaintiff, the trial court did not weigh the evidence. There was no assessment of the credibility of one witness versus another, and no assessment that one party had perhaps more or more compelling evidence than another. There was none of that, Your Honor. The trial court assumed that each and every one of the incidents that the plaintiff complains about in fact happened, and that they happened as she says they happened. There may be material issues of fact. There may be disputes about whether or not they happened. That is not what the trial court did. The trial court assumed that everything happened the way the plaintiff said it happened. She could not have been.
So I can understand this. By way of example, just to take one, the fact that Chief would testify to, and it was asserted that Chief Overton said, if she came back, he would make her life a living hell. He may actually deny that at some point if it were to go to trial, but the trial judge accepted that as a fact for the basis of his finding.
Yes, he did, very clearly in the decision, Your Honor.
And the trial judge assumed that that event and the others that were relied upon were reasons, at least in the plaintiff's mind, why the conditions of work were intolerable.
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court looked at the plaintiff's testimony as advanced in her briefing as the reason.
She may have believed that they were intolerable, but a reasonable person could not conclude that. Is that the focus?
I believe that's the focus, Your Honor, but I would have to question whether or not the plaintiff, during her testimony, even advanced the position that either her decision to resign was her constructive discharge, if you will, was retaliatory, or that she was subjected to intolerable working conditions. There were questions during plaintiff's presentation about what did the plaintiff say that was the reason she resigned. We have a couple of different issues. At one point, one of the items in that 16-item list that the plaintiff points to as evidence that the trial court improperly weighed the evidence is the fact that the trial court said that plaintiff is a bit vague about some of the timing, a bit vague about some of the issues that happened. And in fact, I would submit that the plaintiff was more than vague. She was wildly inconsistent in some of these, in some of her testimony in terms of timing and causation, two things that were critical for her to prove in this case. And in no place.
Well, why does that matter if one of the inconsistencies would allow an inference that supports the claim?
Because there's no testimony that the working conditions were intolerable. The plaintiff made it very clear, Your Honor, and this is in the in the appendix.
But does she have to use certain words? Does she have to say the word intolerable, or can she present evidence that allows an inference to be drawn that they were intolerable?
Yes, Your Honor. She can present evidence that an inference can be drawn that they were intolerable. And we certainly don't expect for a plaintiff to be as informed about the meaning of all legal terms as counsel on the court may be. But this court properly found on all of the evidence, taking that evidence in the light most favorable to plaintiff, that everything happened that she says happened, and it happened the way she says happened, that a rational trier of fact could not find in her favor. The plaintiff did, in terms of the wildly inconsistent point, just to respond to the court's questions earlier about what the plaintiff said, she said a couple of things a couple of different times. And one of the things that she said was, it shows in the appendix at A68, which is her deposition testimony, where she says the reason I left my job was because of the hostile work environment, recognizing that is a loaded legal term. But it's a significant legal term, because as this court recognized in the Rizzitello case, and as the Superior Court found in this case following Rizzitello, that intolerable working conditions such to justify constructive discharge or to constitute constructive discharge must be more than a hostile working environment. And I won't hold the plaintiff to a legal definition because she's not trained in the law. But I do think it's appropriate to look at what she said at page 167 of her testimony, which shows at A68 of the appendix, to that she goes on to say there was a hostile working environment that she claims that Chief Overton created for her, and that she also references there the alliance that Chief Overton formed with Captain Baker, who the trial court described as a professional rival. There certainly is testimony throughout that would justify the trial court's determination. It's not significant to the finding, however, of the trial court that there simply was insufficient evidence, that her proof at summary judgment, her proof on all the record evidence, was wholly inadequate to bring her claims forward to trial.
Why? I mean, we're now in a procedural posture where we're assuming that all of the events that the plaintiff relied on, in fact, happened. I think we're in a procedural posture where we can assume that she believed that those events led to a hostile work environment and were the reasons why she resigned. So, you know, how are we as a reviewing court to analyze and review what the trial court did, given the constraints of a motion for summary judgment?
Well, there are constraints on a motion for summary judgment, Your Honor, but at bottom is still the rule that a party is entitled to summary judgment if the non-moving party's proof is such that no rational trier of fact could find in her favor. And
okay.
Here,
fine. Can you walk us through that analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. Here, Your Honor, there are two problems with the level of proof the plaintiff has, and the trial court identified both of those. One is the sufficiency of and the timing of these various acts that created intolerable working conditions. Plaintiff's counsel in his presentation pointed out the list of six that are in his opening brief, and then added, in addition to that list of, actually there were seven altogether, and added the threat. Taken together, those six acts, a subordinate was removed from her supervision, the chief stopped having daily meetings with her, other management seemed hostile, and one police officer yelled at her. She was ordered by the chief to impose discipline on a subordinate, and then when that subordinate complained, she testified that he got irate and red in the face and he stormed down to see the chief. The chief withdrew the harsh discipline and imposed a lesser form of punishment. She was told by the chief not to attend the holiday luncheon. She went anyway, and she wasn't recognized publicly by the chief when executives from other departments within the university were recognized. And finally, in her opening brief, the issue that during her testimony, the plaintiff said cinched it for her, and that was when the cadet program, which was one of the many responsibilities that she had at the university, was defunded and was no longer part of her duties. And then, of course, the threat. That taken together, the court found, was not sufficient to reach the standard of other cases found by courts in this state, including in this case, before this court, the Rizzitello case, to constitute constructive discharge. Those facts are nowhere near the Anchor Freight case, where the plaintiff was presented with a resignation letter that the management had prepared for her and told her, if you don't sign this, you will be fired and we won't pay you your vacation pay or your final paycheck. Or even the Bally case, which was a decision from the Court of Chancery, where a hospital surgical resident was demoted and put on clinical probation during his residency.
Are you saying that it takes, that she would have had to be put to a choice of resigning or being fired in order to prove her case?
No, Your Honor. I'm certainly not saying that there has to be a direct ultimatum, resign or be fired. There have to be conditions, however. It's clear from the case law. There have to be conditions such that, rather than work under those conditions, a reasonable person would be compelled to resign.
What about a prospective situation that is made clear is going to happen? Does someone have to actually endure that before being constructively discharged, or can they take, in this case, take the chief at his word that life was going to be hell, therefore no point sticking around?
Your Honor, there's certainly no fact in a Delaware case where constructive discharge was found or even analyzed that would say that a threat that I will make conditions or conditions will be made intolerable here is sufficient. It's clear that there have to be actual working conditions more than a hostile work environment, as this court recognized in Rizzitello, that justify a person resigning rather than live under those conditions. So it's very difficult to imagine a circumstance where, as the trial court characterized in this case,
whatever the definition of intolerable may be, if someone is told that if they come back to work tomorrow, that condition is going to exist, they have to endure that first before there's a constructive discharge.
And I don't see any other way to justify intolerable, to show intolerable conditions other than that they would have to occur. Certainly looking at the case law that speaks to hostile work environment and intolerable work conditions, it has to actually exist. I don't mean to imply that it has to be of long standing or that the plaintiff has to go through some kind of truly horrific treatment that would put their health or safety in any kind of jeopardy, but simply that something has to occur, not just a statement that something will occur if something else happens.
Was there any dispute as a matter of fact that after her resignation, the plaintiff unsuccessfully sought employment as a consultant in the very same department that she now characterizes as creating a hostile work environment for her?
There's no dispute whatsoever, Your Honor.
How did she respond to any question at her deposition or otherwise about if the environment was so hostile, why did you ask for a job as a consultant in the very same department?
My best recollection, Your Honor, is that that discussion, to the extent it occurred at deposition, seemed to revolve around the status of independent contractor versus employee. That's my best recollection, standing here, of how she seemed to think that it would be different. Recall, of course, that when she did that, when she asked for the independent contractor position, she had resigned for other reasons. I mean, she had not said, "I'm leaving because it's intolerable." She said, "I've had a rewarding and productive experience here at Delaware State," is what her resignation letter said. She identified that she didn't like some conditions. One other point, but she did not speak to the kind of circumstances that she advances now to keep her claim of constructive discharge alive. Another issue that is very critical in terms of an analysis of those events, and that the trial court addressed specifically in its decision granting summary judgment, is the fact that timing, by her own testimony, is wholly inconsistent with her claims that these intolerable conditions, remember, she has to prove intolerable conditions, and then she has to prove, because her claims are breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing and breach of the, and violation of the Whistleblower Protection Act, for having complained to the Council on Police Training about Captain Baker getting a gun when she wasn't supposed to be getting a gun. By her own testimony, Captain Baker came in to even ask for that gun in the first instance on October 26, 2006.
I'd like to ask you a question about the defamation claim.
Yes.
Why isn't a false statement that someone who's been professionally disciplined actionable on its face as a libel?
Because
without a proof of special damages.
The plaintiff must prove causation, must prove that there was, that as a matter of law, or I'm sorry, as a matter of fact, that she was, that an act that defamed her, that an untrue statement that harmed her happened, and she must prove that as a result of that, some kind of harm occurred, and she's missing that but-for element. She's missing, because she has no witness to testify to it, proof that but-for the statement that she had been disciplined during her tenure at Delaware State, she would have been hired in that particular police class at the City of New York. Of course, we know she was later hired, but she's missing that crucial element. And she had.
Was that lack of causation? Was that the basis of the Superior Court's ruling, or was it lack of proof of damages?
It seemed that the court sort of addressed them together, that there's no damages because there's no proof that as a result of this form that was filled out and sent to the City of New York that she had suffered any kind of damage, that there was a connection between those two.
Ms. McDonough, before we leave the constructive discharge issue, let me just ask you one more question. You would agree, would you not, that the standard on summary judgment would require the court to view the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, who's the non-moving party?
Yes, right? I would, as it did, yes.
And, you know, wouldn't the facts at least add up to a scenario that would run something like this? The plaintiff was the number two person in her department, Overton being the number one, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And a critical part of her job was to, you know, to please her superior to whom she reported, right?
Yes.
I mean, in other words, a good relationship was essential.
Yes.
And the person to whom she reported tells her that before she goes on, you know, leave for surgery, that if she didn't resign but came back, that he would make her life hell. He also, before that time, after, you know, she complained about that Sergeant, or, you know, Captain Baker should not have been issued a firearm because she wasn't certified, went on and issued it to her anyway, made her do it. And then after that, arranged it so that Baker would not be reporting to her. And after that, he tells her, don't bother coming to the holiday party. And, you know, he stopped having daily meetings with her. Now, if you add all that up, wouldn't a reasonable person conclude that the chief has basically made her job untenable? Wouldn't we have at least a tribal fact issue on that?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. And there are major issues in the timing of that as well. The holiday party issue, the plaintiff herself ascribes to the chief not wanting him there because of his wife. And the timing of the and the lessening of the frequency of their meetings is attributed by the plaintiff in her own testimony following a September 29, 2006 luncheon meeting at a restaurant with the chief, at which the chief tells her, my wife and I have been fighting about you. She thinks I'm favoring you. We're not going to be seeing each other as getting having these meetings as much. One month prior to Captain Baker even asking for the gun.
But don't we have to engage in fact-finding in order to even consider that?
We are looking here, Your Honor, at all of the plaintiff's testimony, her own words, undisputed by the defendant, all of the plaintiff's words. It is appropriate at summary judgment to look, of course, at all of the facts, as the court did here, undeniably, in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And to look at those facts as within the whole of her testimony. It is not necessary or appropriate at summary judgment to for a court to have to completely disregard any facts that, particularly when they come from the plaintiff herself, that don't necessarily agree with her position at summary judgment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm happy to give you, because your colleague went 3 minutes over, I'm happy to give you a full minute.
I don't know what to say, Your Honor, but I'll gladly accept.
Well, I'll give you a minute to say it.
Okay. Your Honor, I think Justice Jacobs hit the nail on the head. This is a fact-intensive matter that should be decided by a jury, not by a trial judge.
It's a fact-intensive matter, however, in large part because your client's testimony and conduct seems to be at war with itself. And even in a summary judgment context, isn't the trial court permitted to consider that and to consider that this testimony, self-contradictory as it may have been, was simply not enough to go to a jury?
Well, Your Honor, there may be some contradictions, but I don't think that they're going to disturb the genuine issues of material fact that need to go to a jury to determine whether, in fact, there is or was a constructive discharge here. Thank you for that.
You didn't introduce defamation into your opening, but your colleague was questioned about it, so
yes, sir.
I want to give you a chance to address what was there in the record at the time summary judgment was granted on the defamation claim that would suggest that but for the false statement, your client would have been employed earlier and therefore lost money by not having been employed earlier.
Your Honor, there was no record because there was no request from the defense to ask who our witnesses were or what we're going to do for trial. The question came to me for the first time at oral argument before the trial court, and I was asked at that point, Mr. Martin, how are you going to, and by the way, the only issue that the defense made in regard to the to that defamation claim was damages. It was not causation and damages. It was strictly damages. They said, you know, there are no damages here because she got the job.
Is it your position that the false statement about being disciplined is libelous per se or actionable per se because it impugns the professional reputation of your client?
Yes, Your Honor. Not having been pled, but yes, I do agree that with that.
I'm not sure what not having been pleaded.
Well, I agree with Justice Ridgely's suggestion that given
but
the nature of this defamation.
You didn't plead libel per se.
No, that's correct. That's why I said I did not plead that.
I just want to make sure.
Okay.
I'm clear.
No, I did not plead that per se. But.
Well, what did you plead?
What did I plead? What we pled was I responded. Remember, the Superior Court has a 4-page limit. And I responded on the last page because they did defamation in 2 paragraphs, I believe. And the essence of their issue as to why the defamation claim should be dismissed is because Ms. Smith did not get the job. So I responded in kind that Ms. Smith did, in fact, get the job. When I was questioned at the time of oral argument about causation and damages, I said, Your Honor, we do have a witness by the name of Robert Smith who is prepared to come into court and testify. And then I wrote to the court.
Is there a pretrial order in place?
No, sir. No. This was before pretrial. So there was nothing other than the discovery, and for whatever reason, the defense did not take any discovery of our side other than the deposition of Ms. Smith.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Aye.